welcome to this special Memorial Day edition of Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Today, we hear a story titled, We've Never Been the Same. It's a war story.
From the public radio website, transom.org, in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, this is We've Never Been the Same, a war story. Produced by me, Jay Allison, with Vicki Merrick, and written and reported by Adam Piori.
Even today, 12 years later, the memory is still vivid. I'm standing in the desert of Kuwait, white sand dunes stretching in every direction as far as the eye can see, and I hear someone let out a joyous whoop. I turn, and standing on top of a nearby mound are the driver and the gunner of the Bradley fighting vehicle that's going to carry me into Iraq. They're both about 19, but seem much younger. They're wearing their tanker helmets and jumpsuits, and now they're attempting to sled down that hill on pieces of flimsy cardboard. They each make it about 8 feet, then collapse in a pile mid-dune, giggling like five-year-olds and rolling in the sand. It's all one big adventure for them. Then my mind carries me back to all those movies and books I grew up with about Vietnam, Platoon, the things they carried, dispatches, stories about how that war changed a generation of young men, how it haunted and hardened them. I wondered, what would happen to these kids once we crossed into Iraq? And is this what those Vietnam guys were like before the war? How did you get from this to that?
I remember multiple explosions. I remember being overrun. I remember close contact with an awful lot of folks.
I've always been fascinated by the idea that a single event can change you forever. That we have these moments, these hinges in time where, looking back, we can see something fundamental in our world shift. That's what happened to the guys of Delta Company of the 187th, a ragtag band of Vietnam-era heroes nobody had ever heard of.
Since that night, we've never been the same, any of us.
When I first learned about what they went through, one night in March 1968, and then what happened to them after the war, I couldn't let go of their story. Over the years, as I've come to know these guys, I've thought a lot about those kids on the hill in that desert. I lost touch with them right after we crossed into Iraq. Where were they now? And I wondered, what happens when you lose something, a part of yourself? How do you go on? And what can you do to get it back?
My focus is on the people that died. Nothing else matters to me. And by saying that I failed, that allows me to live with the fact that someone died.
I didn't come to the story of Delta Company looking for life lessons. In the beginning, I just wanted to hear a good war story. Over the course of my career, I'd spent time in some wild and crazy, trauma-ridden places. Cambodia, Indonesia, Iraq, and on one of the longest, most macabre nights in my life, Ground Zero. And in the beginning, for me, just like for those kids on the dunes, it had all seemed like one big adventure. But now I was a features editor at Reader's Digest, each in a suburban office. My fellow editors came from women's magazines like Oprah. At meetings, we discussed the sex appeal of Dr. Oz and 20 things your doctor won't tell you. One day, while wasting time, I came across a website profiling Medal of Honor winners. I liked reading these tales of extreme peril, imagining the battles, the danger, the young warriors out there in the jungle. These were the same guys I'd read about years before. No editors were telling them what to do. There were no stuffed shirts in office politics, just that most basic of evolutionary imperatives, survive. That's when I first learned about the men of Delta Company of the 187th. The Rakusans. At the height of the Vietnam War, during its largest escalation, the Army created this new unit and it quickly gained a reputation for accepting troublemakers and misfits. Then it went to Vietnam and became a company of heroes. As I read the description of these guys, I felt something I hadn't been feeling much at work back then. I was interested. Their story promised everything my life didn't. Tough, macho badasses, action, battle scenes, hijinks. I felt suffocated by the rules in my world. They just ignored the rules in theirs. So I picked up the phone and started to track them down.
We did exciting things. I mean, let's face it, you're walking in a war zone.
Yeah.
Whenever there was an excuse to send someone through the wire, we went.
I met my first bona fide war hero in Starbucks in Ridgefield, Connecticut. I found him easily enough. His telephone number was listed. Paul Bud Buca, West Point, class of 65, captain, retired, awarded the highest honor that a grateful nation could bestow on a U.S. soldier for his actions one fateful night, the Congressional Medal of Honor. In the military, that's like being sainted. It had all begun in 1967, Bud told me, when the U.S. Army started receiving intelligence that the North Vietnamese communists were planning something big. The U.S. was already in the midst of what would prove the largest escalation of the war, but General William Westmoreland wanted still more men. So the call went out.
Fort Campbell was going to be the last division deployed.
Fort Campbell was the home of the 101st Airborne, the famous Screaming Eagles paratroopers. But Delta Company was the last company of the division. And as one vet put it, they got the leftovers. Actually, at first, they got nobody.
And there were no people. It was me.
When he first got there, Bud Buca sat in the empty barracks while the Army looked for men to fill Delta. He had to take daily attendance, even though he was the only one there. Bud even stood on the parade ground by himself, calling out orders to imaginary soldiers. Poor Bud was a spectacle and soon a joke at Fort Campbell.
And then the first eight arrived.
They weren't exactly Rambo or Audie Murphy. One was a typist. He'd been transferred into infantry probably because he pissed somebody off. The other seven
had trouble with basic infantry training, meaning they would not that they had flunked it, but they hadn't passed it. All right. The ones that didn't do that well came to us. But the ones I remember the most were the people who came in and I said, what do you do? He said, I'm a speechwriter. I said, oh my God.
Still, Bud needed more men, so the Army sent him the troublemakers.
So anybody had a guy they wanted to get rid of, they said that we would take him.
As I got to know these guys, I'd hear a lot of stories. They burned down the enlisted man's club, punched out commanding officers, and generally wreaked havoc. I met a war photographer who told me these people were psycho. He insisted some of them had been transferred out of the loony bin.
Did someone come out of the mental ward? I don't know. But should they have? Yeah, sure. Some of them could.
But from this mishmash of leftovers, Delta Company transformed. By the time they got to Vietnam, they were one of the most effective fighting teams in the entire division. One that, for the first few months at least, distinguished itself for, among other things, never losing a man.
Compared to everybody else, we were in combat more often. Detached, seeking the enemy, if you will. We were like a special combat team. Delta Company has this reputation and historical significance of being one of the most highly decorated units in the entire Vietnam War.
A few weeks after talking to Bud, I got laid off from Reader's Digest. Hallelujah, that was all I needed. I decided to unearth the story of the Rakasans full time. Within a week of leaving my job, I was sitting on the couch in a big-time book agent's office in downtown New York City, telling him about these misfits who went to war and all became a bunch of heroes. They were like the Dirty Dozen of Vietnam, I told him. He loved it. If I could get more details, if I could get him a good proposal, he was sure he could sell it. I was golden. It was only later that I would realize the battle was only half the story. That in fact what happened after the war, many years later, was in some ways even more incredible than what happened that night. But for now, I just needed to get started. At the coffee shop, Bud had been adamant on one point. If I wanted to do the Delta story right, I had to talk to Dave Dillard. Dillard was Bud's former radio operator, a former artillery guy sent to Delta after going AWOL for a night on the town. Bud described him as his little brother. I've talked to Dave a lot over the years, in cafeterias, hotel rooms with friends and comrades, at his home in Texas that he named Rakasan Ranch. But the conversation always comes back to the mission that bonded the men of Delta, and the night, March 1968, that, as Dave put it, melded them in the refiner's fire.
There were lots of firefights.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was in lots of firefights. Yeah. But nothing would ever compare to the intensity of this night in March of 1968.
Through Dave, I met other men from Delta. Mike Rawson, a former tunnel rat turned post-war poet. Bill Heaney, a natural-born brawler with a wild past, who finally settled down and now fixed computers at Yale. I met Calvin Heath, a full-blooded Nipmuc Indian from Connecticut, a warrior and an athlete. Great guys, every single one of them. And they all said the same thing.
It was not the biggest battle in Vietnam. It was not the biggest battle the 187th was ever in.
No.
Bill Heaney.
But it was just something that shaped the rest of our lives. We have to carry that with us now forever. Forever.
We knew that the North Vietnamese had pressed a lot of people into the area. We knew that that they had infiltrated. So we knew that we had to try and find them. So going into the mission, there was a sense that it was going to be it's going to be intense.
The mission and all that would follow began on March 16th in the aftermath of the Tet Offensive. After Delta's choppers dropped them off in the jungle, their job was to try and find the enemy and try and kill them.
From the moment we landed, I mean, it seems like it was only a matter of an hour that we started making contact with the enemy.
It was on Delta's third day in the bush, a little before dusk, that things got serious. Here's Delta Sergeant Bill Heaney.
Is it real, real quiet? When it's real, real quiet in the jungle, something's up. Because there's a lot of wildlife in the jungle that make noise, you know, birds, all kinds of shit. And when there's people around, they go quiet.
Dave remembers he was sitting on a log, taking a break and reading the Army Times, when he heard a sound that chilled him to the bone. Dave heard a rooster.
And I'm going, was that a rooster crowing? And we're checking it out, and everybody's going, damn. You know, we're in the middle of Vietnam, in the middle of the jungle. Chickens just don't live. That's not indigenous to the jungle, you know?
Mm-hmm. But we saw the wagon tracks and the bicycle tracks, and I knew. Yeah. I knew we were going to get hurt.
We're in heavy, heavy triple jungle. Tough stuff to get through. We have, in the first part of us, a long-range patrol at a walking point.
With the scout dog.
Which is what they call it.
With a scout dog. I get a call back on the radio. It says, we just had a water carry. A guy's carrying a yoke with water. And he just ran off into the bushes.
Then one of the guys out front asked Bud for permission to do what's called recon by fire, probe by shooting.
I said, sure, go ahead. One clip. He fired two rounds and the entire mountain in front of us just blew up. And that's when I said, oh, my God, the proverbial dog catching the bus. And then I was thinking, what do we do? Because there really weren't reinforcements. We were beyond artillery support.
And within a minute. All hell breaks loose. World War II all over again in that part of Vietnam. I mean, the jungle exploded.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Today on Memorial Day, you're listening to We've Never Been the Same, a war story by Adam Peori from the public radio website transom.org. Here's Adam Peori.
Delta Company had inadvertently stumbled into a North Vietnamese base camp, a big one. There were 87 men in Delta on patrol that night. There were, according to Dave, about 2,000 North Vietnamese standing ready to fight. Mike Rawson later flew over the battle on a resupply chopper.
From up above, all you could see was our red tracers and the Gook's green tracers, and they're just all intersecting each other, just in all different directions, like a psychedelic light show of bullets.
It was in the midst of all this, in the early part of the night, that Bud Buca did some of the things that would eventually win him the Congressional Medal of Honor. Soon after the battle started, Bud told everyone to move back into a small clearing so he could take stock. One of his guys came running back from an area and reported that the long-range scouts were still pinned down.
He said, there's a guy with a machine gun and a Y of a tree. So I said, Dillard, let's go.
I'm following Captain Buca wherever he goes. I'm his ears. I'm his voice. So I'm trying to follow him around, and finally got to the point where we're piling up so many. He said, you have got to stay here and get these people out of here. And I will be up there. I'll get a radio. So then I lost him for maybe 20, 30 minutes there. I wasn't with him. He was out there working up front with, you know, the others that were up front.
Bud grows almost pained when asked to talk about his own heroism and what happened next.
They write it in a citation of if it's very heroic, and that wasn't a big deal. I mean, it wasn't like, oh, well, you know, let's, it just happened and there's bullets flying, but everybody had bullets flying around. So that's the thing, that the distinction is that you don't stop and say, oh my, there are bullets here. No, they're everywhere.
It was like trying to put out a small blaze in those initial moments after it first starts, and you think there's still a chance you might somehow contain it. He was just trying to do something, which made it all the more powerful when I finally did get a hold of the citations and descriptions from men on the scene that night. Dashing from position to position through heavy fire, several eyewitnesses wrote, Bud heaved fragmentation grenades at the enemy, while stopping at different positions to encourage his men. Then, arriving at the position of the pinned down Lerps, Bud crawled 40 meters through heavy fire towards a machine gun bunker and finally silenced it with a fragmentation grenade. Wounded in the hand, Bud fought on, drawing fire away from pinned down soldiers and single-handedly taking on a deadly machine gun nest in a huge tree, emptying an entire magazine until the gunner tumbled out of the branches, hanging dead by a vine. Next, braving another hail of bullets, Bud dashed forward, dragging the wounded back to safety. One platoon leader, Sergeant Kenneth Hilburn, described seeing Bud, quote, brave fusillades of automatic weapons and RPG fire no less than three times to pull individuals to safety, end quote. Soon after, the enemy unleashed a human wave attack on the right, and Bud ran in that direction and organized his men to concentrate their fire on it. Then he pulled them back to a clearing and tried to find a way out. Dave Dillard remembers the utter chaos of the fight. The guns were blazing all around. Reports on the radio were getting bad.
I've got four down, I've got three down, I've got two down. And when we just made contact, I got four down, I got three down. And I'm starting, we're starting to think about these numbers. And they're pulling back wounded to try and, I'm trying to consolidate wounded back in the CP, and which is no CP, which is wherever we dropped the ruck. Where I dropped the ruck, that was it.
The engineers blew a hole in the jungle canopy so they could get the wounded out. At least 40 guys were down at that point.
And here the first chopper comes in, is hovering about the,
ceiling,
I think. And I was, it couldn't have got much closer than that.
No.
And I was fully extended with this guy and somebody behind me, and we're fully extended and we can't reach him. Mm-hmm. And you can hear the side of the chopper getting hit with this
AK-47
or whatever they're trying to shoot at him. And we waved him off and he took off. And as he's taking off, you know, he's receiving fire from the south. And I'm going, and I asked him, are you receiving fire from the south? Because that's behind us.
Yeah.
And at that time, that very time when that happened, I turned around to get, I was on the radio and I looked up.
Out of the corner of his eye, Dave saw an object sail into the perimeter. Then he heard an engineer.
And he goes, it's a grenade! And it blows and knocks out two of the engineers. And then I was knocked backwards and deafened. What I, my mental note was, Adam, was the idea was I need to tell Bud they received fire from the south. But I get a grenade blown up in my, and you know what? I forgot. I don't know whether I forgot or it's something I've had to live with. I didn't tell him. I didn't say. He came back in, and I see him motioning the group to go back south.
Dave was dazed and deafened. He saw the men heading into the trap, but his mind was moving too slowly.
All the men started down that trail with wounded, trying to get down to that LZ. They blew another ambush. They blew an ambush on us. Mm-hmm. Killed all of our people in the relief element.
After that second ambush, Bud realized he and his men were trapped. Then he heard some bad news on the radio from Calvin Heath, that he, his lieutenant Jeffrey Wishick, and several others were cut off, surrounded by hundreds of NVA. Now it was decision time. Bud knew the only hope for the entire company lay in the fact that the enemy didn't know where they were hidden or how many of them there were. So Bud Buca made a choice that would haunt him for the rest of his life. He radioed back Calvin, Jeff, and the others and told them to play dead. The men of Delta would come get them in the morning.
He told me he was there. And I said, that's it, turn the radio off. I can't come get you. We'll get you in the morning. And that's when I had made the decision. There's nothing you can do here. You're just gonna make a mess of things. And you've got to reorganize, get hold of everybody. You gotta get control of this thing. Everybody's just running around. Everybody's going to get killed.
I dug up eyewitness testimonials and other official documents collected after the battle describing the events behind enemy lines. After the explosion, Lieutenant Jeff Wishick staggered to his feet, bleeding profusely, dropped to his knee, and took out six screaming NVA soldiers charging their position. The rest of the Americans they'd come down the trail with were either dead or had made it back to the original perimeter. Wishick, Calvin Heath, and three other men were cut off. The jungle all around them was alive with the sounds of Vietnamese soldiers, so they pulled their wounded off the trail, lay down in front of a giant anthill, and hid. One day, I drove out to talk to Calvin Heath at his brother's house in Cheshire, Connecticut. I asked him what it had been like that night trapped behind NVA lines, lying next to Lieutenant Jeff Wishick, feigning death. The recording isn't great. I had a microcassette recorder to document the interview for the book, but I still listen to it sometimes.
I couldn't see him, but I could hear him. And I could hear him all the way around us. I could hear him moving through the jungle, because you're not going to be quiet. Branches snapping, and they were everywhere, and I could hear him. They were talking in whispers, and you could just hear them. There was hundreds of them. They came in among us, opened fire. Wish it got hit again. They were making sure we were dead. I got hit in the hip, and another bullet went right between my right nut and right leg. That burnt. That hurt. That hurt.
Throughout all this, they didn't make a sound. They didn't move a muscle.
They came in, and they after they opened up fire, they touched us. If you moved, they'd shoot you again.
In the hours that followed, the NVA urinated on Calvin. They trampled him and tripped over him every time they launched human wave attacks against Bud's besieged company. Then it got worse.
One came in and he grabbed me. He was going through my pockets and stuff, and he grabbed my watch off of me. And I didn't move at all. But when he hit me, when he was searching my pants, he hit me in the nerves right there, so I twitched.
Calvin's nerve was exposed, an open wound. The pain was blinding. It was a tiny twitch, but it was enough. The soldier sat up startled. Calvin was sure it was over, until his wounded comrade lying at his feet, Jeff Wishick, grabbed the NVA's shoulder just as he was about to kill Calvin and slit his throat. And it wasn't over, not near it.
They came through us again, and I bayoneted. I killed a goof there. Wishick killed another one. I was face down, and I had my bowie knife in my hands. And when he rolled my body, I just came right up with him and knifed him. The next morning, they came in, and they literally sat on Wishick's chest, eating breakfast. One of them was squatting with his butt was on my legs. And they were there while they ate breakfast. They were talking among themselves and stuff in Vietnamese. You know, we just laid there. We didn't move.
In the end, of the 87 men from Delta and 11 from the recon force, 32 men were medevaced out. 47 were treated afterward for wounds, and Jimmy Sherrill died that night, as did Juan Nazario, Steve Messerly, Paul Connor, Cecil Davis, Roy Estrada, Larry Green, Michael Carroll, Dennis Moore, and more from the recon team. Only two members of Delta made it out unscathed. No one got away without their share of psychological wounds. Miraculously, Calvin and Jeffrey Wishick survived the night, barely. After the final NVA soldiers left, Wishick whispered for Calvin to go back and let the others know they were still alive. He was too wounded to move. Calvin was so shot up himself, his entire spine was exposed, but he made it back. Later, back at the base, Calvin remembers lying in a hospital bed and waking up in time to hear a priest reading Jeffrey Wishick his last rites. Then he passed out again, and when he awoke, Wishick was gone. Years later, Dave Dillard would think often about the bullets coming up from the south and that grenade that blew out his ability to reason when he allowed the men to go south into the ambush. For years, he dreamt about it, every night. What would haunt him the most was the idea that if only he had done something different, it might have ended differently. Survivor's guilt. I heard it often. From everyone I spoke with who was there that night. Even from Bud, the Medal of Honor winner. Especially from Bud.
Every day of my life, I go back over what might have been. had I done something differently. And I'm the one that has the most guilt, because there are 10 names on a wall.
I heard the guilt from guys who weren't even there that night because they were injured before the fight, like Mike Rawson.
I'm in the chopper and I'm looking down on the ground and I'm seeing all these explosions and all these red and green tracers going different ways, and I'm feeling the rounds coming through the chopper, and I ain't got a weapon, so I can't jump out there and help them. I had to go back to the base and wait till tomorrow to find out who made it and who didn't. I had to leave my brothers down there to die because I didn't have a weapon and I couldn't jump out.
All the guys seemed to feel guilty about something, but what blew my mind, what really confused me, was that for many, many years after the war, decades even, most of them never once talked about it. Because though they trained together, partied together, gone over together, fought through that night together, the men at Delta came back home alone. They scattered to the winds, and most of them assumed they'd never see one another again.
Well, we didn't know where the other guy went. That isn't part of the structure of the military to let you know what happened to your buddies.
The decades ticked by, the 70s, 80s, 90s. After a while, some of them began to wonder, did that night really happen? Was it real?
We came back, nobody gave a shit. How do you go to somebody, well, let me tell you, I'm at the bar, right? Let me tell you about this night I had out there. Mm-hmm. You don't do that. You just can't.
By 2010, I'd sat with Delta guys in Kansas, Oklahoma, Texas, and Connecticut. I'd reached out to many more. I'd done a lot of document research, too, as much to help get information for Dave and some of the others I'd met as to write my book. But by now, I'd also begun to suspect I was looking for something else, too. All my life I'd heard it from vets. You can never understand. You're not one of us. You haven't seen what we saw, so don't even ask. But I'd finally found some who were talking. And whether I understood it or not, I was deeply affected by the stories these men told. And some parts of it I did understand. Like how a traumatic experience can make you suddenly feel more separate from others. I sent away to obscure Pentagon offices for documents detailing who arrived when. I got the weather reports day by day in Vietnam. I drove to the National Archives outside of Washington, D.C., and pulled every single file I could find on Delta Company. I read the after-action reports. They were dog-eared, some still streaked with jungle dirt from Vietnam 3 decades earlier. It was in the files gathered to win honors for Bud, Dr. Denny Moore, and that lieutenant who was left out in the bush overnight with Calvin, Jeff Wishick, that I found the most details of the heroics. They were documented with personal testimonials from people for whom the events were still fresh in their minds, and they were far more potent than anything I had heard so far, almost mythical. This is how the battle ended. After hightailing it back to a small clearing, Bud formed the unit up to make its last desperate stand. He ordered everyone to hold their fire, arranged them in a circle, and threw grenades into the surrounding jungle from different locations to make it seem as if the unit was far larger than it was and hide its location. He kept the enemy confused. Without that deception, Delta would surely have been overrun. Later, I heard Dave try and tell Bud that.
Had it not been for your work and your commitment and expertise in that situation, that we would have lost a lot more. There are so many of us that are walking around today and that will always remember you for what was accomplished that night.
I couldn't find the documents for all the exploits I'd heard about, but I'd seen enough to know that in general, it had happened just as they said it did. And one thing was clear. All the men who survived had endured what must have been unimaginable stress for close to 12 hours hiding in the jungle, outnumbered, besieged, unable to fire back. These guys, who back at Fort Campbell everyone had pegged as a bunch of misfits and castoffs, had been transformed. Because they'd been through hell and come back again. There was something else I wanted to know now more than ever. How had these guys managed to carry the weight of that night through all those years without collapsing beneath the load? I kept thinking about those kids in the sand dunes on the way to Iraq. Now the remaining men of Delta had their AARP cards. What was in store for those young veterans I'd gotten to know? One time, Dave got to talking about the hijinks and the fun they used to have. Before that night of March 18th, Dave and his bunkmates Ray Palmer, Dennis Moore and Billy Ford used to get high and play a game with old hand crank radios from World War II. They gave each other call signs, Delta Delta, Butcher, Robin Hood, and called each other up from different corners of the hooch, talking trash using their own kind of radio code, making jokes and laughing uproariously. But that was before Denny Moore died. That was before that hinge in time, when everything changed.
We never played that game again. We put the radios away and put them over there, and it just wasn't fun anymore. And so that's why a lot of guys, when they came back, had to self-medicate. Both those guys, myself included. You know, we just got into the drugs and we went all hell-bent for nothing. What the hell, who cares? What are you gonna do to me that hasn't been done to me? And those were the tough parts, Adam. The tough parts were just not understanding and not being able to talk to anybody. My guys weren't there. I didn't have a cell phone. There's nobody to call. There's no little machine that I can crank and get, you know, Butcher on the line or get Ray Palmer, Billy Ford, and talk to them. I don't know where they are. You're lost. That in itself was devastating.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Today on Memorial Day, you're listening to We've Never Been the Same, a war story by Adam Peori from the public radio website transom.org. Here's Adam Peori.
After Delta Company came home, everyone told the same story. The isolation, alienation, despair, the broken marriages, the anger. I heard it from Bill Heaney, from Mike Ross, and from Ray Palmer, from Bud Buca.
Everybody has the phenomena of living after a traumatic experience called war.
Yeah.
Everybody.
Some people didn't make it, like Bill Heaney's friend Bobby Deitch. He died in a vehicle wreck a couple years later in the U.S., according to Bill, strung out.
I tried to get a hold of him a few years later, but he was already dead. It's one of my big regrets in life is I never got a hold of him again. But what are you going to do? Life's full of regrets.
But here's where the story takes a turn, because there was a way to begin healing. A way for Dave and Bill and Mike and Ray to find their bearings again. Not everybody was gone forever. Not everyone was cast adrift permanently. It started with an epiphany Dave had in the 1980s, but it would take 20 years and the invention of the internet to truly make it a reality. Delta, or part of it at least, would begin to reunite.
I said, these guys are out there. These guys are out there. I said, we ought to find them. And it amounts to is that, yeah, you got to find them and commit yourself to it. So I started with who I knew and talking with them, which I knew very few.
Soon, Dave was spending hours hunched over telephone books in the library. His monthly phone bill ballooned to $300 from calls to directory assistance and long-distance calls running down possibilities. Over the course of several years, Dave found Pete Colantomi in Dedham, Massachusetts. He found a phone number for Jerry Jarrett in Bonner Springs, Kansas. He found a list of Delta names with Social Security numbers and a lady down in Sweetwater, Texas to run them through a database and pull up addresses and phone numbers. Dave found Michael Doyle in Washington State, Nick Gadoris in Mount Kisco, New York, Theron McFadden in Peachtree, Georgia, and Frank Malik in Palm Beach, Florida.
You know, we started digging, and I made all those phone calls. Great phone calls, great times. I wanted us to all sit down. I had questions in my own mind. Did those things really happen the way I think they did? I wanted to see those guys again. Normally, all of them said the same thing. You're the first person I've talked to. I haven't seen anybody. Great stories, wonderful stories.
The reunion story that stayed with Dave the most, however, was one of the first he did. Dave knew that Calvin Heath had survived by playing dead that wild night, and Dave had a Stars and Stripes article that listed Calvin's hometown as Cheshire, Connecticut. So Dave tracked him down and went out to visit him. He wanted to know what really happened out there. Calvin told Dave about crawling for help, about how Lieutenant Jeff Wishick saved his life. Then he told Dave about waking up and seeing that priest standing over Wishick's bed reading him his last rites. I wish Lieutenant Wishick could have made it, Calvin told Dave.
When I was in the hospital, he was laying across from me. And they read him his rights, then they told me then they didn't think he was going to make it. And you know, he was really shot up.
When Dave got home, he kept thinking about Calvin and how sad he'd been. He kept thinking about Jeff Wishick dying. Strange, he hadn't seen his name on the wall. Then a few weeks later, something incredible happened.
I went back and I found this old airborne class book. And I'm looking through here, and all of a sudden I look down and here it says, Jeff Wishick. But I went, oh my God. So I called Jeff. And he said, Calvin made it. Neither one of them, they've been going through life thinking the other one was dead, you know. And Jeff was amazing. He called Calvin. Calvin was buzzing. Calvin was higher than 15 kites. You know what I mean? He was just amazed.
The Delta story wasn't about that night in 1968, really. It was about how these guys were lost and found each other. There was even a focal point for this, a natural climax. Around the turn of the millennium, Dave's efforts reached a tipping point. He'd started with just a couple names. Now his list had scores of Delta guys. It was time to get together face to face. It was time to reconnect the old unit. Around 2003, more than 40 guys from Delta agreed to meet at a state park just a few miles outside Ardmore in southern Oklahoma. They came from points all across the country. Counting spouses, kids, and the relatives of those Delta lost in the battle, about 100 people were on their way there. That night in Vietnam still burned brightly for many of the men. They still carried it with them. As much as they tried to forget, it was there. Yet it had been so many years. No one knew what to expect. Here's Calvin Heath.
Dave called me and stuff. I was starting to wonder if I had done the right thing. You know, I figured everybody was mad at me in the company, you know, and it was just the opposite. You know,
they thought. Why do you think people were mad at you?
Because guys did die that night out there, you know. Okay. And I just, you know, if I could have brought him back, then nobody would have died, you know. But so I just figured they were mad, and they thought I was mad at them because when I went to the reunion, they were shy coming up talking to me because they thought I was mad at them for not coming out and getting us that night.
Mike Rawson.
My first reunion with them in Ardmore. I get inside, and here's all these other guys. And it's like I finally got my family back. For almost 40 years without seeing them, you know.
I was very scared going down there. I was real scared about it.
That's Bill Heaney.
I didn't know what to expect. I didn't know who to see. I didn't know if anybody would remember me. You know, then when I got there, oh, my God, what a surprise.
Yeah, tell me.
It was like happened. It was like we never left, you know. Just like we never left each other.
Bill had his wife accompany him to the first one in Oklahoma.
I remember sitting there that evening and watching these men come in and come over to where we were set up. And the looks on their faces were just, you know, incredible. The way they fell into each other's arms, and after 35 years, they actually remembered each other. And to watch them, you know, turn away and the tears rolling down their faces and sitting down and starting to, you know, relive the night of March 17th was an incredible experience. I know that for my husband, I think that that's when the healing really began for Bill. The kind of healing that took place, that he realized that he mattered. Because I think that all these years, he was so defended against emotion and caring about other people, and that other people didn't care about him, and all the flavors of PTSD and how it affects these men. I think that that was such a major breakthrough for him, that he realized that he was with his brothers.
Hey, how are you?
The old man's getting older.
How are you?
How you doing?
I'm doing wonderful.
Good seeing you.
This is the guy I see all the time.
Morning, bud. How are you?
Wonderful in New York all the time.
Hey, how are
There's
you?
There's Michael. Michael,
I can't believe I finally meet you. Oh, God.
After we left Vietnam, I felt like a part of me never came back. So what it really was that part of me that got left over there was my family, and it was them. And I came home by myself, and I never got to see them all these years. And that was the last healing piece that I needed, the very last one.
There was one person who didn't take part in the reunions, and his absence was felt. Lieutenant Jeffrey Wishick stayed away. So I decided to put off contacting Jeff. I'd wait until I actually began writing the book. The depth of his trauma, his decision to avoid the others. How had he done it? How had he lived with it all these years? Did he know something the others didn't? My book agent called me back with his thoughts on my 70-page book proposal a few weeks after I'd sent it off. What happened to the Dirty Dozen of Vietnam, he wanted to know. Nobody wanted to read another long tome about PTSD. It was depressing. I mean, it was okay, he said. It was fine. But why would anyone pay $20 for it? The characters needed to be larger than life. The action needed to be more gritty. We needed to start over from the beginning to write the proposal section by section. I tried, but then my daughter was born, my second child, and my severance was running low. I'd started writing long-form narratives. Soon I was pulling in almost as much money as I had been in my miserable magazine editing job at Reader's Digest, only I worked in my basement and got to spend time with my wife and little kids. I feared that if I didn't focus on building this career, if I didn't focus on paying gigs, the worst would come to pass. I'd have to get another office job. So I put the proposal in a drawer. I put the voluminous files I collected into a filing cabinet, and I resolved to get back to it later. A couple years passed. It nagged at me. Dave and Bud told me it was no big deal. If they had a nickel for every time someone set out to write Delta's story and then dropped it. But I felt terrible. I kept in touch. I sent Dave Christmas cards, checked in occasionally. But I knew I'd let him down. Calvin Heath died of a brain tumor in 2013. I heard the news from Dave Dillard. Dave told me Bill, Ray, Bud, and Mike would all be coming up for the memorial. Even Jeff Wishick would be there to pay respects to his old friend. He asked if I'd like to attend. I did. This bugle was recorded at the service. After the ceremony, I asked Bill Heaney if he had found a way to make peace with the past.
Sometimes, you know, you just let it flow. You know, sometimes you just let the thoughts come out. They don't do me any harm anymore like they used to. That night's not my enemy anymore. That's what going back, meeting up with all the guys did for us. That night's not our enemy anymore. Yep, it's always going to be there. You got to make friends with it. You got to make friends with it so that it doesn't kill you. I just know that even my psychiatrist says I'm better when I get together with the guys. Yeah, nobody can make it on their own. Nobody.
Unlike the others, Jeff Wishick didn't really seem to want to reconnect with his old unit, other than Calvin. Some of the guys thought maybe Jeff was stuffing his feelings, that he'd have to reconnect eventually when the PTSD became too much, but that he just wasn't ready yet. Others worried he was mad at them for leaving him behind enemy lines with Calvin and the others overnight. No one except Calvin had actually seen him since 1968. Now I had a chance to meet Jeff Wishick. I wanted to know how he dealt with it. So after the ceremony, I asked him how he'd gotten through all these years.
I just decided I have a job to do. I have a family. I have people who care about me. I have things I want to accomplish in my life. There are things that I want to do. There are places I want to give back. So do it. And forget about all this other stuff and move on. Immerse yourself in the world in front of you rather than in the world behind you. I give the same advice to the kids I work with out of Iraq and Afghanistan today. The kid that has five Purple Hearts, or the kid that's a double amputee, or so forth. They say, well, you know, that's fine. Immerse yourself in the future, not in the past.
I kept pressing. Maybe I didn't believe it could be that simple. He'd seen more trauma than anyone that night. How did he live with it all these years when so many other people couldn't? So I decided to try something different. I decided to talk about myself. What came out surprised me. Do you lose a part of yourself when you? I mean, I covered 9/11 from Ground Zero, okay. And I saw a lot of. And I'd lived in Cambodia for a year and a half, and later I went to Iraq, but I'd never actually seen mutilated bodies before. Mm-hmm. And I did down at Ground Zero, and I kind of felt like I lost a part of myself, you know, seeing that, like some sort of innocence. Or I thought that before I always wanted to look in the dark side, you know, I was always fascinated by that. I wanted to see, and I thought I would gain something, some sort of wisdom. But instead, when I saw like a leg sticking up out of the ground, you know, and all sorts of mutilated corpses, I felt this dull, sick feeling, and it felt different. I mean,
but isn't that the human in you? Isn't that the human, this is an incredible injustice and should not happen in you?
I felt like seeing that stuff, it changed me in a way, and I lost something though, rather than gaining some sort of wisdom. So
I disagree with you. I think you got an insightfulness that's caused you to go off and investigate like this activity and maybe others to try to better understand the motivation for things like that and to help. That may be your healing, is trying to help others heal through what you do. You know, you have a void, you have a sickness, there's something that isn't right there. I don't know. That's for you to decide.
Well, we were talking about that. I mean, I put this story down 3 years ago, and then I felt a duty to Dave and Bill, some other guys I talked to get this out there. In part because it's so healing for them to find their comrades, you know, their brothers. There's still guys out there that they want to bring back, and that's their healing process. And I feel like I made a commitment to try and tell their story. Anyone who's ever lost anything and is trying to find it, anyone who's ever felt alone and is trying to find their way back will relate to what these guys and you all, you know.
I think I hear your motivation. I hear what runs your batteries, what makes you do it.
Jeff was right. Through connecting, through hearing each of these men tell me their stories, it made me feel like maybe there was hope for those kids on the sand dune in Iraq, and that maybe whatever darkness I caught the tiniest glimpse of down at Ground Zero seemed a little less forbidding. And now, when those guys coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan cross my mind, I have a new thought. If they get lost, maybe they'll find their way back. Some might not make it, but some of them will be okay. And I have a message for any of the men at Delta Company that are still out there. Hey, Mike Politano, Frankie Parham, Edgar Hightower, Ross Jimenez, Russell Haygood, John Callahan, Frank Hickman. Your buddies are still looking for you. Visit the website. Send them a note. Come to the next reunion, because they need you. And you might not know it, but you probably need them too.
You've been listening to We've Never Been the Same, a war story, written and reported by Adam Piori. The show was produced by me, Jay Allison, with help from Vicki Merrick, for the public radio website Transom.org, based in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. Music was composed, performed, and recorded for this hour by Matthias Bossi and John Evans. To find out more about this program, to see pictures, hear outtakes, to get resources on PTSD, to learn more about Delta Company, or get in touch, visit transom.org. Funding for this show came from the National Endowment for the Arts and from the supporters of transom.org, a website that offers the tools and skills to make your own stories for public radio. This story, for instance, was the first radio piece by Adam Piori. Thanks to Kelly McEvers, Andrea Taube, Samantha Brown, Sydney Lewis, Public Radio Station WCAI, and Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts.
This is Dakota Datebook for May 27th. On this date, in 1931, an F-3 tornado collided with the Empire Builder passenger train, the pride of the Great Northern Railway. The train had just left Fargo, heading east on a hot afternoon. The engineer and several passengers saw a small funnel cloud to the southwest. The funnel bobbed up and down, then the top of a haystack blew apart. Seconds later, the train shook, and the windows blew out in several cars. A farmer watching nearby saw the train lift from the tracks, settle back down, then lift again. He said, "It went flying out into the air and landed on its side. It caused such a huge cloud of dust that I couldn't see any of the train, but soon the engine came pulling out of the cloud. Only the 136-ton locomotive and a 94-ton tender remained on the track. Automobiles soon crowded the roadway, spectators that made the evacuation of the injured difficult. But a rescue train soon transported the 117 passengers back to Fargo. 57 of them were injured. A man from Washington State was killed, and a Mrs. Troll of Minot was reported in serious condition, but was expected to recover." The storm went on for 50 miles through Clay and Norman counties. It was called a definite barn wrecker. 24 farms in Clay County lost buildings. At the L.D. Fleming farm, the family sought refuge by their machine shed, but the storm lifted the shed over their heads and dropped it a couple hundred feet away. The storm claimed a second fatality when it killed an 18-year-old as he and other members of his family crouched in their farmhouse basement. He was struck by a concrete block dislodged from the foundation. A third victim, one of the train passengers, died 2 weeks later from infection. Based on interviews, it was later determined that three tornadoes had merged to form the funnel that struck the train. And coming during the Great Depression, the storm was another blow for those suffering losses. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Christina Campbell. I'm Ann Olquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by Humanities North Dakota, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
And that's a wrap for this Memorial Day edition of Main Street. We are grateful that you could join us again today. Tune in tomorrow at 3 p.m. and 7 p.m. Central for another edition of Main Street.